Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Thursday, May 9, 2019. It is overcast, and rain is predicted for today. Our yellowwood tree and azalea bushes have just completed their blooming, harvesting now plenty of lettuce from the garden, and local strawberries are available, so life is good. Yesterday, I returned to Radnor Lake State Park to interview our guest, Dr. Robert Loeb. Rob is from Penn State University, DuBose campus, and is a specialist on urban forests. He has been studying the forest at Radnor Lake since 2007 and assisting park management in science-based decision-making. Frequent listeners to this program may remember that one of our first guests was Radnor Lake State Park manager Steve Ward. We talked about the extraordinary efforts Steve, together with his staff and volunteers, have made in the removal of invasive exotic plants at the park. In our interview today, Dr. Loeb gets into some real detail about the positive effects of invasive removal. We also discuss the fragile ridgetop forest communities at Radnor and the reintroduction of native grass communities in the park. Dr. Loeb is an engaging and friendly character and a font of knowledge. Get ready to learn something. Hope you'll enjoy our interview with Dr. Robert Loeb. Robert Loeb, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you.
Rob, it's great to have you. Now, just for the purposes of the audience, we're actually at Radnor Lake State Park here today, recording in their little visitor at the visitor center here. And Rob, you have traveled here from Pennsylvania to join us today.
That's right. I came out of DuBose, Pennsylvania, is the Penn State campus that I'm at, and flew in bright and early on Monday morning and got my first day of out working in the field. And so that was exciting. I've been continuing and running ever since.
And here we are on a Wednesday morning. So Rob, you are a conservation professional, been in conservation your career. Mm-hmm. It's kind of traditional in this program. We do interview a lot of people in the conservation and parks and recreation field. How in the world did you get interested in that?
Well, it goes back to my childhood. My mother chased me out of the house and sent me off to the New York Botanical Gardens to learn how to do gardening. One usually says the bug bit you, but the plants got me is maybe the way to say it. I took all the gardening programs and all the children's courses there, and the faculty there and the administrators there took a liking to me. And so they hired me in to become an instructor when I was in high school, and started to do all sorts of odd jobs for them, help them build their botanical exhibits, did field projects. So there's a place called the Hemlock Forest in the Botanical Gardens. I did a total survey of all the trees there, 24 acres.
Wow. So you were in the Albany, New York area?
No. I grew up in the Bronx.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
New York City Botanical Garden.
That's correct.
Ah, okay. So I was thinking of a state level.
No. New York, you're talking to a guy who grew up and probably the worst part of the history of the Bronx is the time when, I think they refer to it on TV as when the Bronx was burning. I grew up in a time when the population, when I was born, was about 2 million people, and by the time I left to go to Penn State, the population was under 1 million people. It was, for the people of the Bronx, it was kind of a terrible time, but for me, I don't really want to say refuge, but found my opportunity at the Botanical Gardens and got myself well involved in botany there. Let's see. So 15, I got my first taste of doing forestry work, albeit urban forestry, which is my specialty.
Right.
Let's see. The next summer, the National Science Foundation gave me a fellowship to work for a month at the Boyce Thompson Institute for Plant Research. So I learned another types of research that different they do at Botanical Gardens. And then the conservation angle occurred in, that was July, and in August I got a Student Conservation Association scholarship grant, I've forgotten actually what they call it, and I worked for a month at the Merck Forest Foundation in Vermont, and I was part of a group who built their natural history museum there.
Fantastic.
And so from there, a few more years working in different projects at the Botanical Gardens, and then went off to Long Island University. Actually, this was an interesting time, because when I was a senior in high school, I was all set to go to the State University of New York's forestry school to study forestry. Seemed like the obvious thing to do after all my experience.
Right.
And my guidance counselor in high school said, "Ooh, forestry's passé, you should study environmental science." Of course, the environmental movement had just been born in 1970, and here I was getting ready to go off to college, and so I literally switched gears and went to one of the first environmental programs in the nation at Long Island University. And so I did a little bit of trailblazing there. I actually got a biology education major, a biology degree, an environmental science degree. So it was a rather jam-packed time, but it was great because you were getting a very broad-based education in all of the areas of the environmental-related sciences. From there, went straight on to my PhD at NYU, and there studied quite a variety of field ecological studies, as odd as that sounds. At that time, NYU had a field station upstate New York, and you're looking at a guy who took all the courses and eventually went on to study, surprise, surprise, the ecology of urban environments for my doctoral work. And then the old story, you finish your PhD, you look for the best job you can get in academia, and off to Penn State I went.
All right. So Penn State, but you're not in the State College campus. You're at DuBois?
DuBois campus, right.
DuBois campus.
Yeah, so Penn State's a really large university, to say the least, 25 campuses. Most of them are smaller in size. My campus is particularly small because we're the most rural of the locations, about 600 students. So our service area is about 60 square miles, and definitely, as I say, the most rural. The specialty at my campus is wildlife technology. It's one of the School of Ecosystem Management's associate degree programs. And so I teach the biology courses for them and the soils course for the students.
Okay.
And get a lot of students who go on for the baccalaureate degree in wildlife and fishery sciences and go out into the various fields. As I like to tell my students, I'm in Allegheny National Forest, but I'm not particularly interested in any trees in Allegheny National Forest. I go to Philadelphia and Nashville, New York, in order to study forests in the inner city.
Well, which is what brings us here today. You've had an ongoing relationship with the management here at Radnor Lake State Park. When did that start, and how did it get started?
Okay, in 2007, my wife was here on a nursing conference. My wife is a professor of nursing, Susan. Give her a shout out.
Hello, Susan.
I was attending a conference here in Nashville, and as I usually do, I would go along with her and go attempt to investigate sites that would be possibilities for me to do research. And so I contacted at the state level and contacted Steve, and I knew that there had been some studies done about 30 years prior, and so I was hoping to be able to resample in the plots that were sampled this time to go and take a look at long-term change. If one were to describe my perspective on ecologies, I take the historical approach. I like to look at long-term ecological changes, and Radnor is certainly studied back in the 70s and then again in the 90s. And so I had two data points, but it was a matter of being able to find the plots. And thank God that the park manager, Steve Ward, is here, and he's walked every inch of Radnor and literally knew where the stakes were. And so I was able to go out and over the from 2007, 2008, 2009, go back in and be able to resample all these plots. And
well, who had done that early work?
I'm getting a brain loss. Okay. I apologize.
That's all right.
It's just not coming to me.
Not somebody at Penn State previously.
No. Okay. He is Tennessean for sure.
Okay. All right. A scientist of some
correct.
Sort. Okay. All right. And so, what has been? There have been several areas of focus I know that you've worked on, one I think, and I'm looking at, and I think my audience may be interested. If you go to the Friends of Radnor Lake State Park website, you will find a synopsis of what you've done there, and I'm sort of working from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that one of the things that you focused on is the effects of the removal of the invasive exotic plants from the park, which has been a positive aspect, a positive change in the park, but you're working to document what that change really has accomplished.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, when I came here in 2007, there really was several questions that I was thinking about. The first one was based on this historical data and the patterns of change. Originally, I thought it was white-tailed deer that was the prime mover in the long-term change in the forest. And certainly, white-tailed deer has had no small effect on changing the reproduction of trees in the forest. But there really is a far more basic problem, and that's the problem of growing space. So if you have something like an invasive species, say like bush honeysuckle, that grows in and occupies all the forest floor, the shrub layer, the sapling layer, then that plant is displacing the seedlings and saplings that would become the new forest. And as I was sort of hinting at, the outcomes of that first study were showed tremendous drop, decimation of the seedling layer, and also a dramatic drop in the sapling layer for the trees that are up in the canopy. So again, if one were to take a look at my peers in other states and who do rural research, everyone points to white-tailed deer browsing as dealing with this problem. Having done research in urban forests in other cities for 3 decades before this, before that time, 2007, I was well aware of the issue of invasive species. Perhaps this is not a polite way of putting it, but when I came here in 2007, one could barely see off of a trail. Plants were taller. I'm 5'10". The plants were well over 6 feet high. And certainly, no matter if I stood on my tippy toes, I couldn't see more than 10 feet in.
Referring to the honeysuckle and the right, privet hedge and that, right. This sort of thing.
Really, the culprit was honeysuckle.
Sure.
At that time, I cut down one plant and discovered one of the larger ones, of course, and it was over 30 years old at that point in time, so the invasion has been long in coming. And as I did my early research, it was obvious that the honeysuckle had spread throughout the forests, well beyond where one normally thinks of it, down in the lower elevations. And so it clearly was a major factor, to say the least. So one of my next projects was to take a look at, okay, what happens in regard to this removal of these bush honeysuckle. Obviously, one can remove an invasive plant and then hope for the native plants to be able to come back in. However, in reality, invasives like bush honeysuckle are quite pernicious. You can very effectively remove them, pull them out. Really going after all the roots and pulling it all out, and yet you will find the next year that there are 5 plants where there was one before. And so it takes a lot of persistence in going back year after year until you really get it cleared out. And so that was probably one of my first questions. I looked at that point in time, Steve had been here for quite a few years, and Steve Ward, of course, the park manager, had been here for quite a few years and had been working in several areas. So the first thing I looked at was, okay, how persistent is the plant? That is, so say in a lower area where the plant is more natural to, that is wetter ground than the higher elevations, which gets drier, is it actually more effective to do repeat removals as versus 1 year in regard to the amount of plants that one would see thereafter? So lots of studies. I do work via plots, and so I do my darndest to hide the stakes that are out in the forest where my plots are.
Sure.
But if one were to go, if one were to have the freedom of movement that I have with doing my research, one would find lots of plots, because we've been laying down plots to study in various places. And the upshot of the research basically was that if in the drier, higher areas, the pulling out of plants more than once, repeatedly, even on an annual basis, is far more effective. However, when one gets in the lower areas, it becomes absolutely essential. The rerooting and the resprouting is tremendously fast. The other aspect of bush honeysuckle that's problematic is that it is a plant that once becomes established, as I said earlier, even the smallest of root tips that are left will produce new plants. That's why you get this notion of five new plants coming out.
Right.
And it's visually, for a person looking at what occurs afterwards, the sprout stays small, that is low to the ground, for about 5 years. And then in the sixth year, it'll shoot up and start to get high. So you really start to see your visual aspect of it not really changing in a treatment site until the plant has again become well established. So when you go out to manage bush honeysuckle, you have to think about it in the sense of, okay, you're going to have a big visual prize when you do the first removal. You get these 6 foot tall plants all out and thing looks nice and clear. The next year you see these small plants and you don't get that visual blocking. You can see into the forest, you can see to the lake. But it's just important in the follow-up years, particularly around the areas around the lake, to keep pulling at it, keep after it. And this has been the tactic that has been used here, that Steve has been using for the years he's been here, and that's been successful. But it's requires a lot of involvement by volunteer groups in order to be able to keep after it. And it's a marvel how many different groups and how often they come in order to be able to do this treatment work. The training is very exacting. There is a native shrub called coralberry, which I wish I saw more of, and it is in some areas starting to take over where in the higher areas, it started to take over where bush honeysuckle was before, and so people are trained not to pull coralberry, which looks very similar to bush honeysuckle, and when it's particularly low to the ground.
Right.
And so it's a lot of involvement. It's not just a simple matter of, oh, there's a bush, pull it out. You have to be careful not to disturb the natives. And it's a bush that puts off chemicals out of its roots. And not all plants are affected, but some plants are affected. And so the recovery of those areas is very slow. It's not a field of wildflowers pops up the next year. So it really requires an understanding of the invasive ecology of the plant and determination and devotion to keep on removing them in order to be able to eventually get the environment clear. And of course, if this were a situation where I am in Du Bois and Allegheny National Forest, where you don't have a lot of gardens around your site, well, that's a lot easier because you're away from the seed sources. But there's a lot of seed sources in Nashville, and so it's a task that you just take a piece. Yeah,
the seed will come in from the outside,
correct?
In spite of your best efforts,
right? And so it's a reality of treatment. It's the best way to describe it is to use a term that my wife uses. It's a chronic disease.
Sure,
you have to really keep after it. Or it's a chronic condition. There's a better term.
You know the park users, I think, have noticed. I guess it's just an impression of an increased an increase in the ephemeral wildflowers in the springtime. And I suppose that you attribute that, or that's attributable the removal of the honeysuckle.
It's a simple calculus. If you remove a plant that's occupying X area of ground, and you make sure it stays out, then something else is going to grow in there.
Sure.
And so it's expected. It's normal to be able to see that increase in wildflowers. As I say, I think that there is a expectation that you're going to see a dramatic increase very quickly. And take it from me, I've been observing these changes since 2007. The changes are there. They're just slower than one might expect when one is a guy from the Bronx who learned all about plants in a garden, and you have an expectation of things popping up when you plant them.
Right.
And so it's a matter of just having realistic expectations, because this plant has been occupying, if not damaging, the environment for 4 decades now.
What do we know about, I mean, we know that this Radnor Lake area was kind of an industrial site there for a lot of its history. It was a lake that was made by the railroad to service the steam engines. What do we know about the natural history of this site in terms of what may have been here before that?
Well, the records really don't go back very far. They talk mostly about lumbering. So there obviously was stands of forest. In my view of urban forests, I'm a person who, I'm the person who wrote the book on old growth urban forests. There are tracks in here are what I would refer to as old growth,
okay,
which goes back to the last major disturbance time. And that, in this area, of course, would have been the Civil War.
Okay.
That would have been the culmination of the removal of forest in the development of Nashville. The greatest time of demand, put it to you that way.
Okay.
But there's reports of selective cutting, moving things like white oak and hickory out of the forests. But That's a little bit deceptive, because there's a lot of evidence from the archaeological information of there being family farms. Probably the best way of putting it. Nothing big agriculturally, but a lot of family farms in the area. And you know, when I walk in the woods, there certainly is plenty of physical evidence of foundations and buildings that were what I would classify from seeing in other sites farmhouses.
Sure.
There was a lot of agriculture going on. So if you think about it in a topographic perspective, the lower areas were agricultural sort of lands, and probably the best agricultural lands got flooded underneath the lake. And then as one goes up the sides of the ridge, you probably had forest that was periodically harvested by the farmers, either for cash sale to the city or for their own needs for heating wood. I can make the observation, of course, that we didn't have fossil fuels to do what we use fossil fuels now until the turn of the 20th century. So.
Sure, sure. So they were reliant on wood to burn.
Everything, construction, everything, sure. With wood.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, okay, one of the other focuses that you've, or there's several other things we need to talk about. One of the other focuses has to do with ridgetops and the communities of plants and trees that occur on the ridgetops here in Radnor Lake. What can you say, tell us about that?
Okay, so let me take a second to digress and just talk about the forest generally.
Okay.
One could simplistically classify the forests of Radnor in this way. There are lakeshore forests, there are forests that are in the ravines, these wet sort of areas that are constantly having water flow through them, or periodically having water flow through them in the drier summer months. And then there's the wet slope forests, which would be those rising out of the ravine areas. And then the drier slope forests rise up. And then finally, of course, you have the forest on the ridgetop. And what, if you didn't hear between the lines, it's soil moisture that really determines the changes in these forests. So you see a lot of the maples down along the lakes, and it switches off from silver maple to sugar maple as you start to go up into the ridges, and the hickories and the oaks are in those slope forests. But when you get to the top of the hills, to the crest of all of the hills that make up Radnor, you get to a particularly sensitive, or I might call it a water-stressed sort of forest, where you get just a very few species. Predominantly, it's a forest that's chestnut oak is the dominant by far, and that's the what I mean by that. That is that more than half of the forest is chestnut oak.
Okay.
But there also are some shagbark hickories and pignut hickories up there, and there's a rather endemic species, pretty rare, but it occurs up there, called September elm. But the reason why you see those species up there is that they have a most marvelous ability. That is that when their seeds germinate, instead of putting up lots of leaves and a stem, they put up a little bit of that, but the vast majority of the energy of the seed is put to producing a long taproot. So the taproot goes down and finds water, which is obviously the most vital thing for any plant.
Sure.
And so when you're in these ridgetop forests, where the water is literally draining away, these particular species are well adapted to be able to grow there. And if one were to look, I spoke about this notion of old growth urban forests. If one were to look at Radnor, the truly magnificent big trees are found up on those ridgetops. The chestnut oaks, the shagbark hickories are very impressive looking trees. People take hikes up to Gagnier Ridge, and Gagnier Ridge is an excellent example of this concentration of chestnut oak and of shagbark hickory and pignut hickory as well. And you really see, just when you walk on it, you really see rock. You don't see much in the way of soil. And so you're looking at trees that are, in order to survive or in order to be able to successfully reproduce, have to be able to get through a layer of rock, sandstone, to be able to get into the soil and to be able to tap the water it needs to grow. So it's in that regard, it's a very sensitive community. If people go off the trails there and damage the seedlings off trail, it can have an effect for decades. We usually think of forests putting down seeds every few years in large numbers, and so there's a lot of opportunity for seedlings. But even in good years, when the chestnut oaks and the hickories are dropping lots of seeds, extraordinarily small percentages have the good fortune to be able to put down those tap roots fast enough to be able to tap the water to be able to succeed. So what I'm really trying to say is that it's a particularly sensitive ecosystem, in that the water stress causes a very low reproduction rate in the first place, and because they're so narrow and people like to be up at the high point to be able to look out.
Sure.
It's a very vulnerable community. So that was one of the reasons why I looked at that and had some students working with me. And we looked at different ridge tops, one that's on the Harris property, the new acquisitions or relatively new acquisitions of property, in order to compare to see how consistent this stressor was amongst the communities. And certainly is true.
Okay.
There isn't that much variety. While one were to look at the different plots that I looked at in the first study I did in the Mesic Forest or the Xeric Forests, there was far more variety. I'd say the one interesting thing that's happening in that community is something that I think most people would not be expecting. Sugar maple typically is found in the wetter forest, the Mesic Forest, but it'll go into the Xeric Forest. What most people don't realize what the other name for sugar maple is rock maple. And so it has a particular adaptation to be able to grow in a rocky setting. So the one thing that is changing in that environment is that the sugar maple is migrating up the slope into the rockier environment, and it's on the edge of the ridge forests. So I suspect in not too long a time, there will be an additional species in the suite of species up there.
So are those ridge tops holding their own?
The forest, the trees themselves are doing fine.
Okay.
But I'll be plain. That's they're vulnerable. When you think about windstorms coming through,
sure.
That's the site that's most exposed.
Sure.
They have deep roots and they're adapted to that situation. But you have microbursts, or you have, God forbid, tornadoes coming through. That could be clear out those ridgetops faster than fast.
So that's something to keep monitoring.
Correct.
And I think important to emphasize, I think what you're indicating is people need to stay on the trails.
Correct. If there's one thing that is single most critical thing to do, stay on the trails.
Absolutely.
I can't emphasize it enough. It's the amount of linear area from one slope to the other, that ridgetop is tiny. You're talking a total of 40 feet. And when you think about getting up to Gagnier, you're traveling over a mile to get up there.
Sure.
And so it's certainly a tiny percentage.
Well, we see the signs around Radnor all the time, you know, please stay on the trails. Off-trail hiking is not prohibited. And this is the reason for that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's talk about another topic, and that is grassland and grasses in the park. And as a casual user, I've noticed the increased sense of there being grasses in the lower areas along the trail. And I know that just didn't happen on its own. That's something that the managers here have made to have happen. What can you tell us about that?
Okay. So, again, forgive me for reminiscing back into history.
Please
but
do
if
it.
If you were to take a look at the aerial photographs, the earlier photographs of this, the property that is now Radnor, not a lot of forest. Mostly it was open fields. And certainly what I hike through when I do my research, let's go back to 2007. What I hiked through when I was doing my research was all forest. And I speak of this notion of old growth forest, and there's a certainly very impressive amount of that in Radnor. But there also was a lot of young forest. So you can see this mosaic of the fields that were invaded and what we call in ecology secondary succession occurred, where trees started to invade the fields. And so again, walking through it with a first look in 2007, it was very obvious to me that there were a lot of fields. Mm-hmm. And it's, Radner very correctly has a protectionist point of view about the area, about the forest. Fully support, wisest way of going, certainly nothing to be critical about. But the management plan here and the ideas here are admirable because they take a look at Radner not from just the perspective of today, but they take a look at it from the historical perspective. And they realize that Radner today does not necessarily represent what Radner was, let's say, 50 years ago. And that's important to recognize because that mixture of communities provides much greater diversity in the animal and the plant communities. So, as I say, quite obvious to me when I walked around where these old fields had turned into forests. And so the challenge becomes, okay, let's turn them back into fields. And the process is not a matter of just taking a chainsaw and cutting down the trees. One needs to be able to get the roots out, and needs to be able to clip through and chew up the wood that's there. Very impressive amount of forest and wood there. So you get this situation where once you remove them and you break down the stems into smaller chunks of wood, you have quite a covering on the surface of the land. So you have to be very thoughtful about, number one, attempting to keep the trees from continuing to be seeded in, but also what it is that you want to reintroduce in regard to the species of the field. So the plan that is here was to consult with experts on the natural wildflowers and grasses that exist in central Tennessee, and fortunately we have experts on that, because this boy from the Bronx is not an expert on that I can tell you. And so they've done this work where they've done in seeding in areas, and it's like everything in nature, it doesn't occur in an instant. There's a lot of, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of wood on the ground, and that has to break down, and that adds fertilizer to the soil, but also the seeds have to be able to pop up through. So reestablishment of field is a process, much like the handling of invasive species, that one needs to be persistent with, and one needs to be very careful about how you manage it.
Let me break in just a second. You're using the word field, and I'm are we talking about naturally occurring meadows or prairies that occurred, or savannas that occurred?
So my choice of field is showing my age.
Okay.
From the forester's perspective, once one removes the forest, one gets a field. But in reality, when one is doing ecological restoration work, as is being done here, one picks a particular environment that one is attempting to restore. And here it's grasslands.
Okay.
And so, as they say, my bad in using the terminologies of my early training.
Right.
But the environment that they're primarily going after is grasslands.
Okay.
And there is quite a bit known about the grasslands of central Tennessee, and so it is certainly a very wise way of going. I can't emphasize enough how much richer the Radnor Lake State Park will be, because you get a whole set of birds, mammals, that exist in grassland environments that don't exist in the forest environment. And I'm looking forward to these changes as they occur.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about I know the Hall Farm is a section of the Radnor Lake that not many visitors really get to see or to experience, but a large field there, a grassland, mm-hmm. being managed as a prairie. They are doing burning that off every couple years to get the herbaceous species out and just to maintain the grassland look. But then you're seeing bobwhite quail and other species that will only occur in that sort of habitat.
It's funny that you point out the use of fire. It's sort of a, again, remembering that I learned my forest ecology in the Bronx, one never even dreamed of setting a fire in New York City Park. I do work in Philadelphia, and I've thought about what we do here in Nashville and suggested it to the folks in Philadelphia, and fire is off the table in Philadelphia.
Oh my.
Yeah, okay. they have a, there's the concentration of people around the parks in Philadelphia,
sure,
much like in the Bronx, and New York City is much different. So you have this, there's a risk factor, and I've been along as they've been doing the burns here. There's always a risk of a freak situation with wind unexpectedly picking up, but it's marvelously safe and marvelously well controlled how the burns are done here, and that's actually very key to controlling the woody species from coming up and also helping to reduce the wood load that comes from the trees being torn up and shredded and being left in place, in addition to releasing nutrients to the environment, to the soil environment, of course.
Sure, sure.
So it's, as I say, one of the things that I've learned from being here at Radnor, beyond all sorts of interesting ecological things, is the wonderful tool that fire is in managing these settings, particularly if one wants to reestablish grasslands. So it's a great tool, again,
and it's a mimic of what naturally happens in nature, naturally in nature. That's mixing it up, but fire occurs, and that is part of the ecology of these areas. And to a great extent, it's been suppressed by humans over time.
I grew up in the age of Smokey the Bear, and that certainly is a concept that holds in the American public's mind about not having forest fires, but the eastern forest, or we see on TV the big forest fires in the west. However, I'll point out that the forests of the east had them more than their fair share of fires as well, and the oak forest, which we're in, is certainly no stranger in its development to having fires.
Let me jump to another topic that we spoke about just a little bit before we got started and went on the air. We were talking about a wild dill species that you have encountered and are monitoring in the park. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, part of the research I've been doing has been in regard to three endangered species. One's nodding rattlesnake root. The second one is copperleaf, Deems copperleaf. And the third is wild dill or yampa. The first two have very restricted environments. However, the wild dill is found in the areas which we refer to as cedar glades. It's actually another forest type that was not recognized by the early forest ecologists who studied Radnor. And I have a sneaking suspicion, probably mostly because they have been developing more recently than at that time. The first, I think, recognition of wild dill or yampa being in Radnor was in 79. It's a species that is only found in cedar glades, and the cedar glade, just to give you a brief notion about it, is a limestone environment, and these plants are what they're called geophytes. So they, although their roots are in soil, the environment typically does not actually have soil on it. It's usually just to a person walking through a cedar glade, it looks like bare rock. And obviously the soil and the crevices between the rocks, and that's what the plants put their roots down into. But the wild dill is a species that's particularly found in these cedar glades. Dill is actually a fascinating species. It dovetails with what we talked about earlier in regard to bush honeysuckle. Dill is what's called a spring plant. So it'll pop up in early, mid-March, and it'll go through its entire life cycle by June. Puts out its leaves, puts out its flower heads, puts out seed in a matter of 3-4 months. And it's successful because, its ecological niche, as it's called, is to be an early spring plant. So it gets most of its sunlight before the leaves come out on the trees. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why bush honeysuckle has been such a successful invasive is that it also puts its leaves out before all the native species do. Matter of fact, even comes out before wild dill. And so one of the reason why we found wild dill was because we were doing some invasive removal going up into one of these cedar glades, and it was the first time we actually went to remove these cedar glades. I should point out cedar glades are found in the environment just below the ridgetop forests. Mm-hmm. So I remember I spoke about all the water going out. Well, literally all the water seeps out from the ridgetop into these layers of limestone, and that provides, in the springtime at least, enough moisture for the wild dill to be able to thrive. So as they were starting to do work in the cedar glades, they discovered this beautiful plant that looks like a carrot in its leaf structure and actually has a subterranean root, something akin to a carrot. And they were surprised by it. And when they called in the specialist from the state, Roger McCoy, he identified the plant for us, and suddenly we realized, wow, we first found it in an area which is called the Hideaway, and there was a rather large population there. And this historical records from 79 showed that the population was there back in 79 in large amounts too. We just never recognized it because it was so overrun with bush honeysuckle.
Oh my.
And so the research that I've been working on since 2014, basically it started in 2013 when we first discovered the plant, the planting started, I should say, is a study in which we lay down plots, which are these areas that we sample plants in, and laid out plots such that we would encompass the entire population of wild dill at a site. And first thing to do, of course, is to lay down this grid of plots and then count the plants in each of the plots. You're able to monitor the change through time. But the second thing to do, in addition to counting the wild dill, is to count the bush honeysuckle, so you know how much was originally there. And then we proceeded to remove all the bush honeysuckle. So one might expect that the next year we would have seen more wild dill. However, wild dill has a very complex ecology or life cycle. The plant seeds have a very low germination rate. Less than half of the seeds will germinate. And the plant in its first year after germination only puts out what are called the seed leaves. That is the leaves that were pop out from the seed, and that's all they do. And then it's the second year, the carrot-like leaf comes into existence, and it's not until the third year that about 10% of the plants will produce flowers.
Wow.
But in the fourth and the fifth year, you get back out to about 50% of the plants putting out flowers. And then once it flowers, it appears that it dies off. So it's perennial for, let's say, up to 5 years, and so it's constantly cycling in these seeds. So our thought was, okay, the old principle of let's open up growing spaces we've been trying to do every other place, pull the honeysuckle out and give the advantage that the plant, the wild dill, had originally of being an early spring plant back into play. No longer would be shaded out. So as I say, this study has been started in 2014, and I didn't get to put together the article and publish on it until last year, and it turned out to be a fascinating article. We were able to show successfully that the population increased, but it's far more complex than just that increase. We eventually found an interaction with the white-tailed deer. White-tailed deer, we never observed browsing, And now that there are large populations of it, the white-tailed deer have discovered it and started to browse it.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
So it's in doing ecological research, there's all sorts of factors that pop up along the way that one would not necessarily think of a priori. And turns out that other people doing studies with other plants have run into this problem. It's what did Sigmund Freud say? Once you identify a disease, you find another 10 cases in the clinic. Once you identify a problem, there's another 10 scientists who find the same problem. And so we're in good standing in discoveries and parallel to others in the discipline.
Well, that's so fascinating. Dr. Rob Loeb, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Mark Fraley podcast.
My pleasure indeed. Thank you.
All right.